I'll fly away. That's not such a bad thing to ask God for at all, is it? Yeah, kids say the greatest things. We were having a family birthday party last night, and Joel wanted to say the prayer. It's his birthday, after all, and so he wanted to say the prayer. And so what would Joel ask God for when he gets to say the prayer before his birthday dinner? God, thank you, why not die? Apparently getting the 3 has been really hard on the boy. I don't know. Between that lately and thanking God continually in almost every prayer for not being eaten by monsters or dinosaurs, we trace that back to he did Jonah and the fish in his Bible class recently, and apparently he thinks God does that to people all the time. So it is precious what our children see and think about and what they want to talk to God about, though, isn't it? I'm in my Bible tonight in the book of Obadiah. Obadiah, no, that's not a joke. I'm there, and I'll ask you to join me as well. That's in the Old Testament. It's just a page of a book, very short, only 21 verses, stuck right in between the book of Amos and, speaking of, the book of Jonah. And so you can either find it. Those of you who use an iPad or a phone, you're in luck. You just get to scroll through and open it. But some of you may want to use your table of contents. No shame in that. Find your way to the book of Obadiah, and that's where we'll be talking about this evening. When you think about action stories, whether it's in a book you're going to read, a TV show you watch, a movie you watch, when you think about action stories, the whole plot of an action story always involves some sort of conflict where it looks like good's going to triumph over evil, the bad guys are going to win, the evil guys are going to get away with it, and then somehow at the last moment the good guys, the forces of good and right and justice win. They save the day, they bring justice, and the bad guys, they lose, they go to jail, they die. And you know why we like those kind of stories and why we make that our entertainment? Because it's how we wish the world was. You ever think about that? We like those kind of movies, those kind of shows, those kind of books, those kind of stories. We like them because that's not how real life works. That's why we escape to that kind of an entertainment, that kind of a story, because that's how we wish it did work. Book of Obadiah. Sits there in the minor prophets, minor because of their size, not because of their importance. Sits there in the minor prophets, and it is God's word about Edom, a foreign nation, but he speaks it to his people, Israel. Well, let me begin reading with you the book of Obadiah. Start in verse 1. There are no chapters, only verses. We're in verse 1 of Obadiah. Vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise, and let us go up against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, and the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal only enough until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? Oh, how Edom will be ransacked and his hidden treasures searched out. All the men allied with you will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy wise men from Edom, and understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. Prophet Obadiah foretells God's judgment upon the nation of Edom, but he doesn't send the prophet to Edom. It's a prophet that sits in Israel's canon. It's a message to the Jews about what God will do to Edom. Why does God need to talk to the Jews about what God will do to Edom? Well, because the Jews need to know that the good guys win and the evil guys get punished in the last day. Because at the time this book is written, that's not how the story is going for Israel. Obadiah comes from a period when the northern kingdom has long been taken away into captivity by the Assyrians, some 150 years roughly before. The book of Obadiah comes from a period where the city of Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, Jerusalem, its capital, has finally fallen to the Babylonians. And the Edomites have taken advantage of the situation for their own profit and for their own pleasure. They have further oppressed the people of God, the refugees and the stragglers that have survived the Babylonian onslaught. And the refugees and the survivors and the exiles need to know that God has seen what has happened, that God knows what Edom has done, and that God will make sure the good guys win and the bad guys get what's coming to them. Story of Israel and Edom is really a very, very old one. Book of Obadiah comes from the 6th century. That's the 500s BC. Comes from the 6th century. But really, the story of Israel and Edom goes back over 1,000 years before. And I want you to go back with me for just a couple of minutes to go back to the beginning of the story of the trouble between Israel and Edom. I want to go back all the way back to the beginning of the Bible. I might want to keep your finger in Obadiah if it was hard to find. We'll come back in a minute. But I want you in the meantime to go back with me. Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25, because that's where we want to pick up with the beginning of the story of what happened between Israel and Edom. It's a very, very old family feud. Genesis chapter 25. Pick up in verse 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled within her. Now think about that for a second. You know, those of you, especially women who have been pregnant, husbands whose wives have been pregnant, you know how fun it is, right? When the wife is pregnant, you look at the baby as though as her belly's growing and the child kicks or hits every once in a while. Mothers love that intimate feeling with their children. She's got twins and they're already at war within her. This wasn't, you know, oh, look, the baby's pushing or they're playing together nicely. She can feel the fighting within her. The children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire of the Lord, what's going on? Are there aliens inside me? What is this? Because this isn't normal. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. God says, I'll tell you what's going on. The struggle starts while they're still in the womb. We're talking about Jacob and Esau here, the two sons of Isaac, Jacob and Esau. We call them Jacob and Esau because Jacob, of course, gets the blessing and becomes the preeminent one, the one through whom God's promises continue, the story continues, and the Messiah eventually comes. Jacob, who later on in his life, his name will be changed by God to Israel, and he is the father of the Israelites. His older brother, his twin brother, but older brother Esau, because Esau comes out first, barely by a hand or so, but Esau comes out first, and his brother Esau will become the father of the Edomites. Two nations, God says to Rebekah, are in your womb. And I want you to understand, the fighting, the struggle, the strife, the hatred, the enemy, enmity, it starts before they're even in this world. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment. They named him Esau. Afterward, his brother Esau came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel, because they're even fighting over who gets to be born first, apparently. And so he's holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. Now when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game. Rebekah loved Jacob. Jacob had cooked stew. Esau came in from the field. He was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished. Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, first sell me your birthright. Esau said, behold, I'm about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me? Jacob said, first swear to me. And so he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate and he drank. He rose, he went on his way. And thus Esau despised his birthright. Esau saw no particular value, no self-denial, no delayed gratification to wait to make his own food. He gives up his place in the work of God. He gives up his place, his rights as the firstborn son of Jacob, twins though they were. He came out first. He was the firstborn son And he sees no worth in that. Over-exaggerates the situation. I'm going to die, so I might as well eat and give up the birthright. No good to me when I'm dead. And thus Jacob swindles, manipulates. Esau knew what he was doing, but Jacob takes advantage of the situation to get something very, very valuable. Turn over to chapter 27. Pick up in verse 27 with me. Because what's going on now is it's come time for Isaac to die. One of the last things that the patriarchal father will do as he's preparing for death is pass on the family blessing, formally pronounced upon his firstborn son, the blessings and all the benefits that come with being the firstborn. But Rebekah knows what's going to happen. She knows that, of course, Esau has given his birthright to Jacob. She wants to make sure that Jacob, her favorite son, gets what, in a sense, Esau has already committed to him sometime before. And so you remember the story. Rebekah has Jacob impersonate Esau down to wearing his clothes, down to covering his arms with animal hair so that he will feel like Esau, so he will smell like Esau, because Isaac can't see anymore. And so she sets about to deceive her husband and help her son get the blessing. Pick up verse 27. As Isaac calls Jacob to come close, Jacob comes close, all the while claiming to be Esau. So Jacob comes close and kisses him, and when Isaac smells the smell of his garments, that clinches the deal. It really is Esau. It sounds like Jacob, but maybe he's just got a cold today or something. I don't know. Sounds like Jacob, but you know, he feels like Esau. He smells like Esau. The food tastes like Esau's. See the smell of my son, he says in verse 27. It's the smell of the field which the Lord has blessed. Now may God give you the dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, and the abundance of grain and new wine. May peoples serve you, nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers. May your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you. Who does basically there Jacob then give preeminence to? Which brother will serve whom? The older will now serve the younger. It's been made so. It's been prophesied, if you will. It's been pronounced by Jacob, or by Isaac to Jacob. But verse 30, it came about as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had hardly gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau came in from his hunting. He also made savory food, brought it to his father. He said to his father, "Let my father arise, eat his son's game, that you may bless me." And Isaac, his father, said to him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau." Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was he then that hunted game and brought it to me so that I ate of it all before you came and blessed him? Yes, and he shall be blessed." And when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." And he said, "Your brother came deceitfully. He's taken away your blessing." And then Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he's taken away my blessing." And he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me?" And Isaac replied to Esau, "Behold, I have made him your master, and all his relatives I have given to him as servants. And with grain and new wine I have sustained him. Now as for you, then what can I do for you, my son? What's done is done. I've given him everything. I've made him the master. Everyone else will be his servants. He will be the patriarch." "Do you have only one blessing, my father?" Esau cries. "Bless me, even me also, O my father." And so Esau lifted his voice and wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, and away from the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. It shall come about when you become restless, that you will break his yoke from your neck." And so Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to him, "Days of mourning for my father are near, and then I will kill my brother Jacob." And so there's a lot of enmity, a lot of anger, a lot of water under the bridge in this family. Isaac has, of course, pronounced that Jacob will be the greater. He will inherit the promises. God will work through him. Esau will become a footnote in history. He will become merely a servant of the greater brother. His people will become servants of the greater nation. Until a time comes, Isaac foretells, when the yoke will be broken from Edom's neck. Nearly half a millennium later, 600 or so years later, Numbers chapter 20, we see one of the first encounters between the two groups, now not as brothers, but as nations. And it's not a warm one. It's not a welcoming one. Numbers chapter 20. What's going on here in this part of the story? The Exodus has happened. They are no longer slaves in Egypt. The Israelites, however, are on their way to the promised land. But to get to the promised land, to get to the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they have to pass through the territory that belongs to Edom. And so Moses, Numbers chapter 20, beginning in verse 14. From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel. See how he begins? They know the history. They know the story. They know the relationships. They know the animosities. Behold, your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that's befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt. We stayed in Egypt a long time. The Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out from Egypt. And now, behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. In other words, we're not going to steal your food. We're not going to eat your crops. We're not going to be like locusts on your land, eating you out of house and home. We will not pass through your field. We will not pass through your vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway. That's a well-known route in the ancient world. That's like an ancient interstate. Well-known route. Caravans use it. Public property, basically. They have a right on one level to pass through it. All we're going to do is drive through town. That's all we're doing. We're not getting off the interstate. We're not going to eat anywhere. We're not going to touch your water. We're not going to use anything. We're going to be no inconvenience. We are literally just going to pass through. Go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or the left until we pass through your territory. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with a sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we will go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But Edom says back, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Welcome to the neighborhood. We're going to be neighbors now. This is going to go just swimmingly. So Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. And so Israel turned away from him. And so Israel has to take the long way towards the promised land because Edom will not even allow them to drive through town. Just pass through. We're not going to get off the road. Just let us pass through. And Edom says, oh, absolutely not. No way, no how, nowhere, never. Oh, it's a powerful grudge. So what happens by the time Obadiah shows up on the scene, another half a millennium, actually another 1,000 years later, by the time Obadiah shows up on the scene, Israel's time in her promised land is done. Her sin has been so great. God has sent punishment. The northern kingdom is long gone. The southern kingdom finally falls. The Babylonians have ransacked Jerusalem. And Edom, all Edom can do at this point is clap her hands and take advantage of the situation. The yoke is finally broken. They have been waiting for this for so long. Israel finally suffers. Israel gets her comeuppance. We love this scene. And in fact, we'd like to join in and participate. And God's people, even though they know they're suffering rightly for their sins and that God's punishment against them, their loss of Jerusalem, of temple, of land is just, they know the stories, they know the history, they know the animosities, they know the prophecies, they know the blessings and the cursings. And they can't believe how Edom has turned treacherously against them in their most vulnerable time, in their most difficult moment. And they need to know that God sees and God knows and that God will still bring justice. You see, here in the first 9 verses of Edom, we learn a little bit about the character of the Edomites. What have they done with themselves? What have they done with themselves in the nearly 1,500 years since Esau, their father, was born and since they were driven away? Well, they've inherited a relatively desert and rocky land. In fact, some of you know the ancient city of Petra, a place that a lot of people want to go and visit. The Edomites did not build Petra. Their successors, the Nabataeans, who will ironically be God's, probably rightly understood as God's scourge against them, God's punishment against them. The Nabataeans who follow them into that region built it. But if you picture last scene from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, that ancient city of Petra, that was ancient Edomite territory, extremely hard to conquer because it was in the rocks, in the hills, it was in the mountains, it was high, it was easy to fortify, easy to defend. They lived high in the hills. And indeed, you look, starting in verse 2 there, starting in verse 2 of Obadiah again, look at what God says about Edom. What has been the mindset, the character that Edom has developed in their years in this land? We've heard the report of the Lord. Verse 2, behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, and the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Because again, they know, militarily speaking, the strategic significance of where they live, the great place that they're at. They live on top of the rocks. It's impossible to get up to them. Who will bring us down? Though you build high like the eagle that is up there in the crags of the rocks, your cities in the mountains, though you build high in the rocks, in the clefts of the rocks, though you build high like an eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. And then he goes on to describe how thoroughly he will ransack them. You know, a thief only takes as much as he can carry. When people harvest a field, they can't carry everything. They leave some to be gleaned later. When I get through with you, you'll be stripped so bare, so thoroughly destroyed, so utterly annihilated. Oh, like the thief or robber could only dream of doing. Oh, how Esau, verse 6, will be ransacked, his hidden treasures searched out. God indicts Edom, number one, because they're arrogant, because they're proud. If you read the Bible much at all, you know how God feels about the proud and the arrogant. God cannot abide by pride. Why are they so arrogant? Well, they have a lot of defense. They have a lot of natural advantages. They are a people who's not particularly troubled by Babylon yet. They're well fortified and in good shape to defend where they're at. Well, other things, as you go on and read through the book, and if you just know the larger story of Edom, they had other reasons to be proud as well. They were known for their wisdom. In fact, here in the reading, it talks about Teman, that God will judge Teman later on in the book. It speaks of Teman. Remember in the book of Job, Eliphaz the Temanite? Eliphaz was most likely Edomite. The Edomites were known for their wisdom, for how clever, how sophisticated, how smart they were. Jacob may have gotten the best of Esau, but nobody got the best of the Edomites very often after that. They were known for their wisdom, for their cleverness, for their shrewdness. They had alliances, and indeed, that's part of what God says will happen when God brings his judgment upon them. All, verse 7, all the men allied with you will send you forth to your border. Those who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. You think you have alliances and you think you have friends. You think you're secure in your situation. These people are going to turn against you. You're proud because of where you live. You're proud because of your wisdom and your cleverness. You're proud because you have alliances and you have solutions to your problems. But I will tell you, God has an issue with those who live by pride, who trust in themselves, their planning, their own possessions, their own positions. Pride is a dangerous thing. Pride makes us believe things about ourselves that aren't true, that we've had more to do with our success than we actually have. Verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. And so in God's opening words of judgment against Edom, we need to be warned as well, lest we become Edomite, as it were, that we look at where we live and how we live and not make it all about us. But going on in the text, what specifically has Edom done to bring down God's wrath and God's ire, particularly at this time? Because of violence to your brother Jacob, you'll be covered with shame. You'll be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you, do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. Do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. Do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives, and do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. What's Edom done? What has Edom done, particularly at this time, this place, has brought down God's anger so severely on them? Well, for all the centuries of animosity, for all the wrongs back and forth that had been done, for all the hatred and all the strife, for all the jealousy and for all the envy, for all the blessing and all the cursing, in this particular era, when Edom saw the Israelites, Jacob's heirs, at their most vulnerable, when they are finally, to the last person, driven from their land, when they lose Jerusalem, when they lose the temple, when they lose the capital, when they lose their king, Edom, number one, can only stand back and rejoice. She can only stand back and enjoy it. Oh, you stood aloof. You did no help. You offered no support. And at the same time, you were like the foreigners who entered their gates. You wished in your heart you could have been with the Babylonians, going in and trampling their city, destroying them, slaughtering them, making them suffer. You wished you were there. How dare you do that? And not only that, but then what else does Edom do? Edom loots Israel's wealth. What the Babylonians can't carry, the Edomites help themselves to. They loot what is not theirs. They rob Israel. The blessings that God had given his people over time, that now they are losing in judgment. Edom, who has not part of God's scourge against Israel, God makes very clear through other prophets, it is Babylon who is his tool of punishment. Edom has no part in this, but what Edom does is insert herself into the situation, seeing an advantage, centuries of animosity, and she helps herself to Israel's stuff. And God says, how dare you do that? And then the third thing that they do, they stand at the crossroads and they catch the refugees. Those who had survived the Babylonian sword, who were running for their lives with only what they could carry. Edom would see them as they were running through their territory or running toward their territory. And Edom would capture them, kill them, imprison them, turn them over to the Babylonians. But Edom would capture them rather than offering them sanctuary, rather than offering them help. They are brothers after all. All Edom can do is see an opportunity to pile on in the worst possible way. At the end of the day, this is a book that's really not to the Edomites, it's to the Israelites. It reminds them that God will bring justice. God knows about the centuries of hatred and animosity. God knows how from the beginning of their national existence, when they wouldn't even let them pass through their land, down to the present moment when they have looted and slaughtered themselves and captured and helped and cheered on the Babylonians. God knows. God reminds them that I'll bring justice. God says to Obadiah, I've taken notes, I've taken names, I know who did what, and I'll make sure it's handled. You can bank on that. God rightly judged his own people, but Edom sinfully takes advantage of the situation and piles on. It's kind of like what happens at home sometimes, right? You ever have several kids and you discipline one of your kids? There's something especially, I think, about children. They especially as they start to get a little bit older, kindergarten age, they like justice. That's why they start tattling. You ever think about that? That's why they tattle, because they want to see justice happen. Abby's at that age now. And sometimes she'll just come up. You know, Joel's supposed to be in his bed at nap time. Joel's in his room playing, and she comes, and she wants you to know, Joel is playing. And she never leaves it at that. Then she says, punish him. Sometimes she even recommends her own ideas. God doesn't want it that way among his children. You're brothers. Israel and Edom are brothers. Israel needed her discipline this day. But Edom, you have no part in this. How dare you rejoice in it? How dare you help yourself to their stuff when they're vulnerable? How dare you actually help the Babylonians do what they're doing? You have no part in this. And so God pronounces his judgment. For the day of the Lord draws near on all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. Because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow and become as if they had never existed. But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy. I will do to you as you have done to others, as you have done to my people. And rest assured, you have not actually crushed my people. You may have thought that you were helping put the final nail in the coffin of Israel, that it would be their name blotted out from history, that they would disappear from the pages of the history books. But no, I tell you, my mountain will be holy again, and my people, there will be those who escape, even escape you, Edomites. And my people will gather again on Zion. My mountain will be holy. The house of Jacob will possess their possessions. The house of Jacob will be a fire and the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau will be a stubble. You may have thought that you finally got your vengeance against Israel. But I will tell you, they will rise again and they will destroy you. They will set them on fire and consume them so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau. For the Lord has spoken. And it didn't take long for that to happen. Because within a few decades, God miraculously restores his people back to Jerusalem. His temple is rebuilt. His people recover their land and rebuild their lives. But over the next several centuries, Edom loses her land. Again, I mentioned the group, the Nabataeans. They lose their land. They disappear for the most part from the pages of history. By the time of Jesus, think about it. By the time of Jesus, you read about Israelites. You read about Jews. Do you read about Edomites anymore? Not really. Oh, they show up a little bit here and there, the scraggly tail end. For instance, Herod the Great, who was part Idumean, your New Testament will tell you, part Edomite. Another reason the Jews hated them so much. Oh, there's a couple left here and there, you look around, but they have by and large disappeared. They have been dispossessed from their own land. As you've done to others, so it will be done to you, God says. They have been dispossessed from their land, their cities plundered, their people slaughtered. And they disappear into the dust of history. God says, I know. I know what they've done. I'm taking names. I'm in control. I'm watching. I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we need to be reminded of that in our lives still, don't we? We live in a world now like then where the wicked often pounce upon the righteous, where God's people are often abused, when even when we suffer justly for what we have done, others love to pile on and make it worse. And we need to know that God is still in heaven. He's taking names, he's writing notes, and in his own time, in his own way, he'll bring justice. He will set things right. And instead, the thing that we need to remember, the thing that we need to know, the lesson that we need to learn, is that we not become like the Edomites. Number one, the attitude of pride. God starts with that before he even speaks to the specifics of what they have done and why he's so angry with them now at this time, why they have finally crossed the line and he will break them for what they have done. He starts first with their heart, and the key to their heart is their pride, their absolute, their utter arrogance. An attitude of superiority can be utterly deadly. And so lest we become Edomite in heart, be careful how we use our position, how we use our advantages in life. Let me ask you something. Look at your own life and ask yourself, does your life show off how successful you are or how successful your God is? How do you live? What are your values? What's your emphasis? What are your priorities? Who do you give glory? Who do you give thanks to? And secondly, this book reminds us that God never forgets those who hurt his children. God tells his people, I know who they are. I know what they've done. I will not forget. I know who they are. And believe me, the day will come when they will get what they have coming to them. And I will give you, my hurting people, justice. You will live and they will die. Your hope is not lost. I will bring you home. My mountain will be holy once again. You will be there to see it, and they will be gone. And that's a word we still need tonight. We need a reminder in a world that is so utterly broken and has been for a very long time. Nothing new about that. God's people have often had to wait in this world, wait patiently for the timing of the Lord and the bringing of his just judgment. And even now as we go through life, if you do right, you're probably going to suffer for it, suffer unjustly at that. God knows he'll set things right in the last day. He knows who has done what to you. He won't forget. He'll give you your justice, his own way, his own time. If you simply have faith to purge your own heart, learn the hard lessons that trials and suffering can bring, and have faith in him to see you through to the end. If you're here this evening, rest assured God's justice is coming upon the world. But if you're not right with God on the terms he's established, on the basis of Jesus Christ, you will be on the wrong side of God's justice at the last day. When he comes to give justice, he will punish sin and those who commit it. He will reward the righteous and those who live by it. If you're here this evening and you are not right with God through the person of Jesus Christ, no matter what else you're going on in your life, you need to understand that in God's eyes, you are one of the unjust. You are one of the ones who warrants his punishment because you are living in rebellion against him. If you're here tonight and you realize that that is your situation, but you want to be on the right side of God's final judgment, we ask you this evening to look into your heart, examine it closely. If you know when you understand the story of Jesus, the meaning of his life, the significance of his death on the cross for your sins, his blood shed so yours doesn't have to be, come forward this evening and confess your full faith that Jesus is the Son of God who died on the cross in your place and was raised from the dead 3 days later in the power of God. And even now is at God's right hand making intercession for us. You come forward tonight, make the confession of your faith in that reality, his sonship, his lordship, his messiahship. Repent of your sins, change the course of your life, live by God's values, not your own anymore. will baptize you for the forgiveness of your sins. You're saying you're a child of God, but you have become one of the unjust again. You are somebody who is living contrary to God's dictates, which makes you, no matter what you are doing or how innocent you think what you've done is, you are fundamentally unjust. You are fundamentally living contrary to God's justice and God's standards. You need to pray to God for forgiveness tonight, lest he judge you for your wrongdoing. Bring your heart, bring your life back into conformity with God's will tonight. We'll pray with you and for you. We'll help you in whatever way we can. If you have a spiritual need that we can help you with it, share it with us right now while we stand and while we sing.